I made this joke already this morning, but when you work in the artificial intelligence, you learn that AI turns out to be easy and AV turns out to be hard, because we can never seem to get our AV to work. So we actually should have a lot more respect for the AV crews who do make it work. I'm not trying to insult you over there. But thank you for making it happen. So how are we doing? Are we doing better?
Techtopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi. Den er udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Teknologiens Mediehus, HI-messen, Index Award, Innovation Center Danmark og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Techtopia. Den 29. oktober her i den forgangne uge, der skulle vi faktisk have fejret en 50-års fødselsdag. Jeg kommer lidt for sent med at fejre, men jeg vil alligevel gøre det, fordi det handler om, det er, at internettet faktisk fyldte 50 år. Fordi den 29. oktober om aftenen, der var der 50 år siden, at en ung studerende, som hed Charlie Klein, han sad på University of California i Los Angeles og sendte en besked over nettet til en computer på Stanford Research Institute til en fyr, der hed Bill Duvall. Den her transmission, den skete over det, der dengang var kendt som ARPANET. Og ARPANET, det var i virkeligheden en gruppe computere, som blev brugt til forskning, der stod på nogle forskellige universiteter, som var blevet koblet sammen i et net. Og i dag så lyder det jo ganske simpelt, fordi i dag taler alle computere, telefoner og alt muligt andet jo sammen. Men dengang så var der faktisk problemer med at få de her computere til at tale sammen, fordi de var af forskellige mærker, og de talte forskellige sprog. Men det lykkedes for en lille gruppe forskere at skrive en fælles protokol, som det hed, hvor de så kunne kommunikere med hinanden, de her computere. Og i løbet af den her aften, der fik de skrevet det simple ord login til hinanden. Systemet crashede et par gange, men det kom til at virke. Og ret kort efter kunne man sidde på Stanford og arbejde på en computer, der stod flere hundrede kilometer sydpå i Los Angeles. Og hvordan fejrer man så det? Ja, her for en måneds tid siden, der havde jeg en samtale med en fyr, der hedder Brad Templeton, på konferencen Technomania i Herning Messecenter. Brad Templeton er i danske kredse nok mest kendt for sine mange foredrag om selvkørende biler. Han er lidt af en pioner inden for det område. Han har arbejdet for Google med at udvikle selvkørende biler, og så har han arbejdet for Singularity University. Han gør ikke nogen af delene mere, men han har også en baggrund som internetpioner. Han har nemlig været med siden 1970'erne, hvor han lavede den første avis på internettet. Han lavede det første site, hvor man kunne fortælle vittigheder. Det lyder måske lidt fjollet, men det minder på mange måder om den måde, Facebook fungerer på i dag, bare uden datakapitalismen og annoncerne. Og så har Brad Templeton i mange år spillet en afgørende rolle i det, der hedder Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF, der er sådan en digital borgerrettighedsorganisation, der kæmper for, ja, borgerrettigheder på nettet. Så derfor så var det helt naturligt at tage en snak med Brad Templeton om, hvordan nettet har udviklet sig fra at være sådan et forskningsbaseret net mellem universiteter til sådan et anarki, hvor alt kunne lade sig gøre, en masse hippier slog sig løs der i 70'erne. Til i dag, hvor det blev kommercielt og sådan et datakapitalistisk overvågningssystem, som er domineret af nogle store amerikanske selskaber. Og så måske en lille snak om også, hvordan vi kommer videre derfra. Brad Templeton, han bor i Silicon Valley, selvom han er kanadier. Og så har han også et lille glimt i øjet, kan man vist roligt sige, udover at han elsker dansk wienerbrød. Jeg skal beklage de første 3,5 minut af det her interview, som i øvrigt blev lavet live foran et publikum og transmitteret på Facebook samtidig. Og derfor så blev det optaget både på et kamera og kørt ind i en mixerpult og tilbage igen til min iPad. Og det gjorde altså, at jeg mistede overblik en lille smule, så de første 3,5 minut, de er lidt forvrænget, lidt overstyret. Man kan godt høre, hvad der bliver sagt, men hvis du ikke kan holde ud, så kan du bare spole lidt frem. Og de første 3 minutter, ja, de handler om, hvordan Brad Templeton, han blev berømt som manden, der opfandt dot i .com.
Let's go back in time. You are very often presented as the guy who invented the dot and .com. Why is that? I mean, what is the story?
Yeah, I mean, I think invented is a strong word. It was just a a matter of being in the right place at the wrong time. In fact, I was a student, so it is a long time ago, or just graduated, something in that range. So in the earliest days of what was called the ARPANET, before it was called
when is that?
ARPANET stood for Advanced Research Projects Agency, which was the American Defense Research Group.
We're back in the 60s now.
Well, this is not in the 60s, but okay. That organization did start in the 60s.
Yeah, okay.
But they built the original network. It was built started in the late 60s. It grew in the 70s. And by the early 80s, it was starting to get a larger audience. And so they just had a very simple system for names, and the names were mostly for just email and file transfer. And so everyone said, we're going to have to make the names more complex, so we'll have levels of names. And so people said, why don't we have, actually, I might have suggested this too, but I don't remember who did, you know, dividing it up into corporate and nonprofit and education, because these were the big users of this network at the time. And originally it was with email, and so the main guy, the guy who was really responsible for most of this, a man named John Postel, who's now dead, he suggested, why don't we do it as something like user.google.com, for example, if you were going to be using, Google didn't exist then, but if you were going to use that. And the reason was that the old mail software would have seen the .com and it would have said, okay, I better send the email to com if I don't know what this is, and com would figure out to send it down. That would be a fix to make the old systems work. And I basically said, that really reads ugly. It reads a lot better as user@google.com. And that was it. People said, yeah, you're right. And so that's how it went. So that's how we ended up splitting dots.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, but it's this is a thing of great, very widespread, but of not really that significant. I'd hate to be remembered for that.
What would you prefer to remember? No, that's the question we save for last. What you would like to be remembered for?
No, I think you can ask it now, because I mean, certainly I hope to do more big things at all times, of course, but the biggest thing in that period, or in the 90s, was founding the first internet-based business. And in that case, I did it, again, not through any special genius, but many people wanted to use the network for business. It had always been dreamed that we would eventually do all sorts of business on it, but this, at this point, not the military anymore, but the American Research Funding Agency was paying for the network. And so they said, nobody can do business on this network because it's a research network. And so I found a loophole. I found a way to do a business on it within those rules, and I convinced them that it was within the rules. And so I started selling an online newspaper. So I built some software to bring in all of the major news wires and sources from other, or news from other sources, combine it together, deliver it to people using internet formats, and they could read it not just every day, but of course, as everyone is used to today, every hour, every minute, and get up-to-date news. So
just keep talking. I'm just doing something about
the sound. Problem. As usual, I made this joke already this morning, but when you work in the artificial intelligence, you learn that AI turns out to be easy and AV turns out to be hard, because we can never seem to get our AV to work. So we actually should have a lot more respect for the AV crews who do make it work. I'm not trying to insult you over there. But thank you for making it happen. So how are we doing? Are we doing better?
Anyway, going back in time.
Yeah, so
you did a newspaper on the internet.
That's right, and that started a giant wave of people doing business on the internet. Now, my newspaper was supported by subscriptions. You had to pay a fee to get it into your company. And of course, several years later, people started doing advertising. Nobody actually had that much success with advertising for the first few years, until finally Google came along and really showed how to do it.
You also, back in the old days, you had something called bulletin board systems.
Yeah.
And you did something called reg.humor, which was a repository of jokes, as I understand it.
Yeah, so that wasn't a bulletin board system in the colloquial sense. It was a thing called Usenet.
Ah, okay.
And Usenet actually predates, I think it was born almost exactly the same time as the bulletin board systems of the same era. But it was the social community of the internet, basically, once it got off the ground. It was the place you went to discuss anything on the internet. There was only really one. And there was an area where people told jokes to each other, of course, as you would expect. And it was shall we say, not the highest quality of comedy. It was, you know, people telling the same joke again and again because they didn't know who'd been there before. So I said, why don't we make one where I actually edit it and I approve the jokes, and so only new jokes come through and only funny jokes where I define what funny is. Right, but, you know, so it was not a discussion so much as an edited publication, which is hardly a new idea, but was actually radically different from most of what went on in these online discussion areas.
Because they weren't edited.
Yeah, that's right. There were a few, but mine was one of the few to be edited for quality, not just for... The ones that were edited just to keep the idiots out, right? The, what we call the flamers, that term's still around. It originated there, actually, in mailing lists and these discussion groups. But anyway, so people really liked it, right? So, because it was funny, and you got one joke a day or two jokes a day, and maybe they made you laugh, and so people liked it. So that became the most widely read thing there was on the internet from about 1988 until Yahoo came along and probably surpassed it in terms of more users, and that would be about 1994. Now, it became famous in 1998, though, because someone didn't like one of the jokes, and so they got it banned in a few places. And so whenever you try and ban something, immediately it becomes popular. That's got a name now. They call it the Streisand effect, but it happened long before that name arrived.
Do you remember any of the jokes? I mean, which one is your favorite? Do you have a favorite joke from that?
I don't know if you can really ask a question like that. I mean, I of course I remember a lot of them, but trying to name a favorite one. Most of them you don't want to repeat in this erudite audience. I was quite willing to be what you'd call politically incorrect today, and in fact, try and run for prime minister, I'm doomed because of the record of the jokes that I published. You can't get a job because you have the wrong tweet.
Right. Give us one. I know you can.
Well, I'll give you a programmer.
Okay.
A programmer's joke.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this programmer goes to her doctor and says, my wrists are hurting. And the doctor says, oh, I think you've got carpal tunnel syndrome. You're going to have to cut out half of your programming. And she says, well, which half? Writing specs or going to meetings? So.
Okay.
All right. The nerds are laughing.
Okay.
That's 30 years
ago. What you described here is sort of the early internet, the early World Wide Web.
Yeah, but before the World Wide Web.
You talked about how you could edit it, how you could actually control some of the content, but it was still very free and very anarchistic, as I understand it and as I remember it.
Yeah, one of the beautiful things, and actually, oddly, also its downfall, was that nobody owned it. Mm. Right? It was just a collective. It was just... all the sites participated individually. Everybody would connect to another site, and they would exchange the information, and so it spread through a mesh, what we call today a mesh. And so there was no one owner, and that meant there was no one who could fix things when they went wrong. Websites were different. A website had an owner, right? It had someone who maybe even made money from it eventually, and so that made them very motivated to do things on their website, to innovate and so on. Because no one owned it, it became very hard to innovate. And so when new things arose, it didn't catch up with them. And it still exists, but it's not really used in that way anymore. It's mostly used today to send dirty pictures.
So what you're saying is that when it became more commercial, it was easier to innovate because you had money in the equation, so to speak.
It's hard to innovate when you have to get 10,000 people to agree.
Yeah.
I mean, it happens, but you've been to standards bodies meetings, right? Standards bodies are probably worse because there's also people have these agendas and motives for the companies they work for. But many people would argue about exactly why it didn't improve, but that's my theory, is that because no one owned it, nobody could say, all right, we've got to compete with what's going on the web. It's actually very sad because there are ways that system worked that still are not matched today. You could read stuff much faster. You could participate in discussions in more interesting ways. Now, a lot of bad things grew up there too. This is where spam originated, as we call it today. And this is where flame wars and all these things, they're all originated from that culture.
But then again, if you look at Usenet as it was back in the days when you did your joke site, your joke group.
Yeah, not a site.
it sort of reminds me of what Facebook is today.
Certainly there are things there that are found in Facebook. Facebook, though, A, has an owner, and B, of course, it tries to focus on small groups. One of the problems that arose as the community got very large is what I call the problem of too much signal as opposed to the problem of signal to noise. Every engineer knows about signal to noise and trying to, you know, pull out the good stuff from the noise. But the problem is if a community gets very large, there's actually too much good stuff. There's more interesting stuff being written every day by your friends than you have time to read. And so the big challenge is how do you manage to stay in touch with your friends and the news and what's going on in the world and not overwhelm yourself and not get addicted and spend all your time constantly checking it, which, let's face it, probably everyone in the room's had that experience. Everyone watching on Facebook has had that experience of wishing they spent less time on Facebook. Because, and not because they think it's noisy or they think there's too much bad stuff there, it's because there's too much good stuff there. Mm.
But if you can, I mean, you mentioned before the flamers.
Yeah.
And today you have the trolls and you have fake news and so on. So is this something that has been with us on the internet all the time, actually?
It has. Well, the idea of fake news, specifically of countries making propaganda and sending the propaganda out through the networks, that's recent. Mm. In fact, I think it's fair to say that very few people, I'm sure there were some very smart people who predicted that long ago, but most people were caught by surprise at the idea that foreign spy agencies would be coming in and trying to manipulate us using our computer network tools. I mean, in hindsight, it's pretty obvious. Everybody suspected it, but I don't think they thought enough about the way it was going to happen. And now that we do know about it, I hope we're actually going to be able to deal with it, because it's a serious danger.
If we should compare the internet of today with the internet that you sort of started with, which was, I considered it sort of being a Wild West with a lot of hippies, sort of digital hippies, moving into this platform and this new world and created something new. And then it became commercialized. And today, I mean, we are hating people. We're all hating stuff from Silicon Valley. I mean, we hate Facebook. We hate Google. We want to change it again.
What happened along the way? You don't. I mean, I'm not from Silicon Valley originally, but I do live there. You don't hate Silicon Valley. You love it, right? What you hate is that you love it too much, right?
Probably.
Yeah. I mean, because of course, to give some credit, Silicon Valley isn't forcing you to use its technology. You're lining up to buy its technology, right? In front of the Apple Store or getting on Google. If Google shut down, you wouldn't say, "Oh, good, Google has shut down." You'd panic. And Facebook shut down, maybe some people would say, I should probably handle a day without Facebook. It's true. Mm-hmm. Maybe a little bit more. No, it's a love-hate relationship. And the issue is, of course, as we love these technologies so much, we become so dependent on them that we fear the amount of control that gives the companies who make them over our lives. And we also fear the fact that as what they do becomes bigger and bigger, their mistakes become bigger and bigger, and their mistakes affect and hurt more people, or even not mistakes, just unintended consequences of what they're trying to do can sweep Brexit votes into power and sweep crazy presidents into power.
But when you describe...
I believe crazy is the official Danish... The official Danish description of Donald Trump is crazy, right? The Prime Minister said. Okay, so we can say that here.
Yeah, that's no problem. No, but I'm thinking, if you look at Usenet and you tell me that the problem with Usenet was that you had to have a large group of people coordinate and agree and stuff.
Well, once it got very big, yeah.
Yeah, and then when you commercialized the World Wide Web, it became easier because you had innovation, and then eventually we had these big sites like Google and Facebook where you don't have to agree on stuff, but you sort of just like buy a service with your data.
Well, so that is actually a very interesting question. This the consequence of advertising being the only or most of the way that people found to make money on the internet. And that is a tragedy, I think. Mm. Now, it's kind of obvious why it happened. It's very compelling to be able to give products away for free and make money from advertising. It's much easier to attract a lot of users The venture funding industry basically was also very attracted to the idea that you could massively grow users and then make money from it later when you gave stuff away for free. I mean, in the early days, they gave stuff away for free and didn't have advertising. But obviously, in the end, most people settled on using advertising. And so, yes, when a product is paid for by advertising, there's a joke people say. They say, if you don't pay for it, you're not the customer, you're the product.
Some people don't think this is a joke, actually. They're really much
attention. Well, no. It's true, but there's one counter to it, because I've puzzled about this. I would love there to be a way to get things like Facebook and pay for them. And because Facebook only makes, around the world, about $7 for every user they have. Now, they make about $80 to $100 for every user in a rich country, but over the whole world, they make only $7. But I'd pay $100 a year for Facebook if that meant it was always devoted to pleasing me, the customer, as opposed to pleasing the advertiser. Mm-hmm. But I've also felt that might not solve the problem. And the reason is that Netflix is another service that I use, and I do pay them $100, more than $100 every year. And it's not like Facebook, but Netflix seems very interested in addicting me too. Netflix, when I watch the show, and it comes to the end, and it's the cliffhanger of the first one episode, and then immediately it starts playing the second episode, and you find yourself, you sat there and watched it for 5 hours or a whole weekend, and it's not what you intended to do. So the companies that are getting money from you every month, they're also motivated to addict you and to just make you want to come back and never leave and pay the money. So it is hard to find the answer. Getting rid of advertising, I've often thought that I have some business ideas in this area, that if I could reinvent money in a way that you could make websites that people paid for and it was seamless and invisible and frictionless, which it isn't if you have to put a check in every or make a charge every month. I got to admit, though, that you know when I pay by tapping my phone, that's kind of scary, actually, not because it's super convenient, right, to just tap. But boy, it sure makes it easy to spend money, doesn't it? Right? Just tap, no signing, nothing. You don't even see it going on. Then you just get this big bill at the end of the month, and you realize, oh, I spent all that money. So the people we're giving that money to are very interested in making it easy for us to give them that money. And that's not always in our interests. So I don't know if getting rid of advertising is enough to solve it, but I do think that if there was serious choice between advertising and other things. Now, I want to give Google some credit. Now, I did work there for a little bit, and they've been friends of mine since before they started the company. But one thing I learned while I was inside is they actually send a strong message to all their employees. Don't you dare think about how this will make money. If we catch you trying to think about how this makes money, unless you work in the ad department, they're supposed to think about that. But the rest of you, if you think about that, we're going to hit you. Because they really believe in their internal slogan, everyone says, don't be evil, was their slogan, and it was one of their internal mottos. But they have another internal motto, which is focus on the user and everything else will follow. So they have tried very hard to not be driven by the advertising force. And I think, except on YouTube, which is a property they bought, I think they've succeeded most of the time. I think YouTube is running those ads in front of the videos and stuff like that. That's not in the interest of the user. But by and large, they've done a decent job. But there are a lot of sites that haven't, and where what they do does indeed get perverted by what the advertisers want instead of what the user wants.
2 days ago, I went to an academic lecture by a professor from Harvard called Shoshana Zuboff. You have probably heard about her. She wrote this 700 pages long book about data capitalism. And her message to the 600 people in the room was that we should make laws that would close down this business model you're talking about, which Google and Facebook are using, the advertising model. But it seems like you don't quite agree with that, or?
Well, there are two things I don't agree with. I'm really hesitant to think that the government, and by the way, in the United States, when I think of the government, I think of Mr. Trump. But to think that the government knows better how to run online sites than the people who build them. I'm not saying the people who build them are perfect and don't make mistakes, and we can't learn some principles. But something as big as that, it scares me a little bit, that amount of control and power. But secondly, yes, I think it would probably be good, but I'm not sure enough that I would say I need to make a law forcing it. If you had to pay for Facebook, how much would it really change, other than that those ads would disappear? I think they'd still want you to be just as addicted to it to make sure that you let your credit card be billed every month, whatever fee it was. If anyone here wants to talk, or how would Facebook be different if you had to pay for it?
And they would still need your data, I assume, to sort of give you a service that you would pay for.
So they would not need your data to pick which ads to show you in the same way. But they would want it because, I mean, in some ways, this is not an evil motive. They want it to be really attractive to you. That's a normal thing for companies to want for their products, right? Now, they've gone over the line. I have a different model, actually, that I've proposed. I proposed a theory of morality, which says that it is perhaps immoral or unethical to exploit bugs in the human psyche. Now, a simple example of this principle is gambling, right? We know that humans have a bug about gambling, that we can get addicted to gambling, we can gamble away all our money without thinking about it. A lot of people go gambling and, you know, they're fine. They gamble a little bit, they have a good time. They don't ruin everything. But some people go and they gamble and they lose all their money and they don't understand what's going on. And so we understand that there's this bug, and alcoholism is another bug in human physiology. And so we already have agreed that exploiting those bugs is a bad idea. So marketing also, in many cases, is they're trying to exploit bugs in the human psyche. And maybe we should start thinking about that. Maybe we should start saying, if what you're doing is trying to unconsciously redirect somebody, then maybe that's not moral.
And then again, you would have to make a law about that to make it efficient.
You might make a law about it. You might make a rule about having to disclose what you're doing. Or you might make a rule saying, no, you don't do that. But that's a much more subtle rule than just saying you can't have advertising. I think saying you can't have advertising is maybe attacking a symptom and not the problem.
If we go back in time again, I know that you have been very active in an organization called Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Yes, absolutely.
Fighting for civil rights of citizens on the internet. Could you tell us a bit more about that? Because I'm not quite sure what is well known in Denmark, actually.
Hopefully it is, but it was founded in 1991, so it's coming up on 30 years of life. Mm. And I joined its board in 1997, so I've been involved with it for a long time, and I was chairman for 10 years. So it was devoted, in fact, to this question of the world changing very fast, new technologies that even the people building them sometimes don't understand. And we knew, because we'd already seen, that governments also are very confused about it. So the organization was actually founded when there was a guy who was a game software developer, or actually a game developer. He made card games, and he was making computer games too. And he got raided by the Secret Service because he made a hacking game. And it was, you would just play at hacking into a computer. It wasn't real, it was a game. And the Secret Service agents got confused and they confiscated all his computers and shut down his business because they didn't know what was going on. And so we came in and provided a legal defense and we won. And later we did things like fight a law in the United States called the Communications Decency Act that said, you can't be indecent on the internet, whatever that means. And trying to censor
it. That's your jokes.
That's the jokes? No, I was a plaintiff. Even though I'm not an American, I've been to the Supreme Court of the United States twice, which I think is pretty good. And this was one of the times I was one of the plaintiffs in that case against the Supreme Court. It was actually before I joined the EFF. EFF was involved in that case as well, though. And we won that as well, 9-0 in the Supreme Court. We lost a case, the second case we did in the Supreme Court, unfortunately the other way. And that was a case about whether it was legal or not to make a file sharing site. If you weren't distributing copyrighted music, just your users were doing that, like Napster and so on. It wasn't about Napster, but it was about one of the companies like it. And we did lose that.
So where is EFF, as it's called for short, where is it today? I mean, what are the
causes it's
fighting for?
It's bigger than ever before. It's still continues to look at free speech issues, I think, primarily. A lot of privacy issues. We've actually now started taking on issues about AI and privacy and civil rights. Issues like what happens when AIs are deciding whether you should go to jail or not, which is happening. There are many parole boards that use AI tools that are sold by companies to help decide whether you should give a prisoner parole or not. Now, one of the reasons people thought that would be a good idea is that they've started to examine human parole boards And they discovered that if you came up for parole just before lunch, you were going back to jail. And if you came up for parole just after lunch, you had a decent chance of going free. Right? And just the mood of the people on the parole board was affecting how you were going to be judged. And that's clearly very bad. So they said, let's see if we can get an AI to score all of the attributes about the prisoner and how well they're doing and are they doing the right things and what was their crime. And they trained it on the decisions of past human judges. This is a standard AI technique for training neural networks. And now one of the factors they did not put into it was what color is the skin of the convict. And yet they found out it was prejudiced against black people, even though it didn't know they were black. So it turns out from learning from prejudiced human judges, right, because they were making decisions, they were unconsciously keeping black people in prison longer because of their biases. Well, the AI trained from them made the same error. And so now you may say, well, okay, fine, it just learned from bad humans and now it's repeating that behavior. The AI itself is not necessarily evil. But the problem is because we were holding this out as this impartial algorithm, and it turned out to not be impartial, it's now become an issue to try and figure out how do we apply AI in government, in crime and punishment, and all these other factors, and not end up making it worse.
Which brings us to the term ethical data. Is that something, I mean, we discuss ethical data a lot in Denmark, even at a government level,
yeah,
that we should have data that is ethical, because we use the data to train these AIs that you talk about. Is that possible in your opinion?
It's very challenging, right? I mean, generally our philosophy at EFF has been a little bit, the European philosophy is, well, I make a joke, it's the government has to know everything about you so it can protect your privacy. And the American philosophy is they don't have a philosophy about it. It's just whatever happens, happens. The GDPR, you know, puts a lot of regulation on companies, and mostly it caused everybody to get spam back in May when it went into force, and it causes you to get a little cookie box every time you go to a new website. But underneath, is it actually going to protect our privacy? It's hard to say. I think the only thing that truly protects your privacy is not giving the data away in the first place. But we haven't found good solutions to do that. It's unfortunate. What we found is when we make it easy to give our data away, it gets done. And it's kind of a weird paradox. Ease of use is normally a good thing. Everyone designing computer systems says, yes, ease of use. But if you make one of the things that's easy to do is to give away your data, like you can push a single button and transfer a lot of data, or you can say, log in here with Facebook, and suddenly that site gets access to all sorts of things from your Facebook profile. You make it easy to hand over your data, and so it gets handed over. A lot of people would like to see a world where you actually don't hand over nearly so much data, but we haven't figured out how to build that yet. But we have generally found that if data is handed over, even if it's handed over for a specific purpose and under a bunch of rules and regulations, that it finds another purpose pretty soon.
I know it's dangerous to predict the future. But if we should...
Actually, all of my predictions that I remember have come true.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you would be brave enough to do some predictions here. I'm just thinking...
No, remember, I said only the ones that I remember. I've forgotten all the ones that were wrong.
Yeah.
There were more of those.
Okay, if you look at it, if you look at the internet now and say, okay, it could develop into a dystopian future, and it could develop into a utopian future.
I don't think it's a dichotomy. I think it's going to be both. It's always been both, and it's going to continue to be both. There's going to be heaven, and there's going to be hell. I do think that the broad arc of history, to paraphrase Martin Luther King, has been one of improvement. You know, I'm a fan of Steven Pinker. Have you seen his book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, or his book on the Enlightenment? He has a lot of good data that shows that in spite of what we hear on the news, because the news focuses on what's going on bad in the world. There are news stations that say, here's the good news, but nobody, you know, tunes into that, right? You always want to hear what's the trouble in the world. And so we do have an impression there's a lot of trouble in the world. And in fact, the actual data suggests maybe it's not as bad. So many of the things, poverty and war and strife and so on, have all been going down for a long time. That does not mean there aren't some bad things happening and there aren't some bad things that are going up. But the general trends have been good. But it's not universally good, and it's not universally bad.
So it's going to be both.
It's going to be both. And we're going to have a role in deciding which it is, right? So that's why you have organizations like the EFF. And it's why you have governments, too. The hard thing is to figure out how to do it with foresight. It's very easy to look back in the past and say, we could have done that better, right? Here's what we know now, and we could have done that better. What's a very hard question to say is, how could someone then have figured out how to do it better? What policies, what principles of ethics or society could we have so that we have foresight to not ruin things? Now, I just spoke here at this conference about self-driving cars. And I mentioned that there is 1.2 million people dying in car accidents every year, and that people hope that if you make a car that drives more safely, that it's going to seriously cut that number down. And it's not going to get to zero, but let's, you know, for academic exercise, imagine that it's going to save 1 million lives a year someday in the future. Now, it turns out the math shows that if you delay the day of adoption by a year, 1 million more people will die because of your delay. 1 million more people. You know, 100 people during the course of this interview will die in car accidents. Now, what happens is the savings of lives takes place slowly and over time, but the aggregate, the integral over time, is exactly equal to the number that die in the period of delay. So if you were to go back and say, how should we deploy this technology? What cautions should we take? You know, what companies, what rules should we put on the companies who are making the technology so to make sure that they do it more safely? And we could come up with some rules. But we're only going to come up with the rules we can think of today. We're not going to think of the perfect rules we know in hindsight. But if what we do in trying to come up with those rules delays it by a year, well, then 1 million people will die. And I can guarantee you we won't save 1 million people with these better rules. We'll save some people. And obviously, their deaths will be very tragic and beyond, against the goals and intentions of everyone working on it. But that's a stark number. Now, human beings are not utilitarian, though. The utilitarians are the ones who just count the numbers. And they say, save 1 million people, kill 100 people. That's a win. That's the pure utilitarian view. Humans don't work that way. At least individuals don't work that way. You know, a famous problem they'll give people is, I give you 5 patients who need organ transplants. They're going to die if they don't get their organs. And I give you 1 guy just walking down the street who's healthy. Should we go out and grab him and harvest his organs and give them to those 5 people so they will live? And of course, he will die. And nobody says that's something we would ever do, right? Yet governments do make these risk trade-offs for the world all the time. And it's very challenging. And I don't know how to solve that problem, if we try to be perfect and take no risk, a lot of bad things will happen. If we allow every risk to happen, some bad things will happen. We have to figure out a way to be people of foresight. And I look back in the past and I don't see a lot of history of us being very good at it. In fact, you know, there's a lot of people like to talk about what happens to jobs as computers start replacing tasks that people do today, from podcast interviewer to software developer, and of course to driver in the case of the self-driving car.
Yeah.
And everyone says, you know, that's going to be very disruptive for the people who are making a living in these things, which is true. But you can go back through history and find book after book after book, going back to the 19th century, of, oh my God, machines are going to take all the jobs, it's going to be horrible, what are we going to do? And they've always been wrong. You know, the advice the books gave, the predictions they made, always wrong. We found a great letter. We did a conference on this job question a few years ago at Singularity University. And we decided it was a very big problem, and it was maybe a good idea to write a letter to the president. You know, maybe many people have heard of a famous letter to the president by Albert Einstein and other scientists during the Second World War. It made him think about how to stop the Second World War with bombs. And we said, maybe it's time for a letter to the president about these issues. And we started thinking, what would we say in this letter? And someone in the back of the room says, oh, I found another. Someone already wrote a letter to the president about this. And they're saying all these things. And I said, great. Oh, what letter? Let's see it. It says, Dear President Johnson, the letter's from 1964. What were computers like in 1964? What jobs were they taking in 1964? 100 years ago, 50% of the people in the world, actually in the wealthy world, worked in agriculture. Now 2% of the people in the world work in agriculture. All those jobs went away. Would we have tried to reverse that decision? Would we have said, let's not have farm machines because they're going to take away the jobs of all those people working in architecture? So it's very hard to find examples of when we had foresight in the past. And so how do we judge when we have foresight today?
The Swedish
he's an
academic at Oxford University. Carl Benedict Frey just wrote a book called The Technology Trap.
Yeah.
And he's saying that, well, what you're saying is true in sort of the longer perspective. The short perspective, people will lose their jobs.
Yeah.
There will be social unrest. But in the longer perspective, you will gain from it. So society will gain from it. So what do you do in the short perspective when you have all this unrest?
But that's the question.
Truck drivers being taken
for example,
out of jobs and so on.
Yeah, like truck drivers you're going to talk about. So truck drivers in the U.S. kill 4,000 people every year. And about 2,400 of them are truck drivers. They kill themselves. So is that okay? Should we protect their jobs in order to have that keep happening? Yeah. No.
That's a good question, but...
Yeah. So that's a thing that's very hard to say. So the answer, by the way, for truck drivers, fortunately, is not as bad as people fear. Right now, in truck driving, there's a giant shortage of drivers. And the turnover rate in truck driving, because it's such an unpleasant job, is sometimes over 100% a year. Like, nobody lasts more than a year in it. There are some people who take long careers, but most people come into it and leave it quickly. And as a result, if you start replacing truck drivers with software, mostly you'll replace them by attrition. And so it won't be people losing their jobs. It'd be a long time before you get to where you're taking this career truck driver who's been driving for 30 years and he doesn't have a job anymore. So at least there's some good news there. That will eventually happen, though. And so then it does make sense to say, well, maybe we should have programs to retrain people, find them new jobs, or find them different jobs in the same industry, and so on.
Brad, I know you have to catch a plane. It was a pleasure. And you're going back to the States?
Yeah, unfortunately, I do have to go back, and so I will not be able to get good Wienerbrot.
Which is one of your favorites.
It's everyone's favorite thing about coming to Denmark. I mean, it's not the only thing, of course, but it's definitely something the Danes know how to do very well.
Apparently, there are
some good Danish engineers, too.
I guess you can get some Wienerbrot around the corner if you want.
There you go. That's excellent.
Okay, thank you.
Great to talk to you as always.
Ja, det var internettets 50 års fødselsdag med Brad Templeton. Vi fik aldrig helt svar på, hvad vi skal gøre med nettet de næste 50 år, men det er jo det, Techtopia handler om hver uge. Så hver mandag, der kan du stadig finde podcasten på techtopia.dk. Du kan deltage i vores backstage-gruppe, som den hedder, på Facebook. Og du kan følge Techtopia på Twitter, @techtopia.dk. Og du kan skrive til mig på henrik@techtopia.dk. Som noget nyt, så kan du også høre Techtopia som et radioprogram på Radio 4, den nye radiokanal. Jeg sender hver søndag kl. 13.05. Og hvis du ikke lige når det, så ligger den som podcast hos radio4.dk. I den her uge, der har jeg besøg af Christian Grøndahl fra Sniper Biome, der er ved at udvikle fremtidens penicillin ved hjælp af CRISPR-teknologi. Og han diskuterer sammen med Jan Madsen, der er professor på DTU Compute. Jan Madsen, han har lavet en computer, som er et sådan et mikrolab. Altså det vil sige, at han tager faktisk sådan et laboratorium, som det Christian Grøndahl bruger til sin forskning. Og så formindsker han det, så det dybest set kan ligge i lommen og ikke større end en smartphone. Og det vilde er, at han faktisk også kan printe sit laboratorium på et stykke papir, så du kan lægge væsker på papiret og analysere dem, for eksempel blod eller spyt eller andre væsker, som du skal finde bakterier i. Men det kan du alle sammen høre mere om i Techtopias FM-udgave, og den kan du som sagt finde på radio4.dk. Og på søndag, der går vi på igen kl. 13.05 med et nyt emne. Techtopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi. Den er udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Teknologiens Mediehus, HI-messen, Index Award, Innovation Center Danmark og IDA Forsikring.
Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Techtopia.
Techtopia.
So how are we doing? We doing better?